obviously, if tomorrow they just came out and everybody makes $5 an hour, there would be thousands of people in the street. But, you know, just keep cutting away at laws. Just keep cutting away.
So we really got to come together.
Yes.
To not only to maintain what we've worked so hard to build, but to keep it going forward and to create a better future for the next generation of workers. So that's about all the time we've got, guys. It's been a lot of fun. Kevin and Derek, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For
thank
coming
you.
Out today. And Fernando, it's been good seeing you again.
Nice seeing you, Ann.
All right. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is Labor Radio. Stay tuned for the next show. Thank you.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of How We Got On at the Portland Playhouse, Wednesday through Sundays until October 25th. Directed by Jen Rowe, How We Got On is the story of three teenagers in the suburbs of the Midwest who dream of fame in the golden age of hip-hop in the late 80s. That's How We Got On, Wednesdays through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. through October 25th at the Portland Playhouse, 602 Northeast Prescott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hip-hopping is the thing that's in. It's where the Stone Cold Nitro party begins. So listen, party people with the ear to the street, the college professor and the social elite, to the fly young guys and the pretty girl. IT is going to tell you about the hip-hop world. Hip-hopping is a way of life.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Good evening and welcome to Prison Pipeline. Prison Pipeline is a weekly program here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM. We address all aspects of the prison industrial complex. We look at prisons from the inside and from the outside. We're about restorative justice, and we're mostly about abolishing the prison industrial complex. Today on Prison Pipeline, my name is Emma Lugo, and we have a series of hosts who rotate throughout the month. Today is my show, and I'm going to be interviewing Chris Hermes. Chris Hermes is a Bay Area activist who has worked for nearly 30 years on social justice issues, organizing first with ACT UP Philadelphia in the late 1990s, spurred his interest in legal work, and led to his years-long involvement with the R2K Legal. Since 2000, Chris has been an active, award-winning legal worker and member of the National Lawyers Guild, and has been part of numerous law collectives and legal support efforts over the years. In this capacity, he has organized dozens of press conferences and spoken at numerous community meetings, political conferences, book fairs, and other events across the U.S., and has written extensively in his professional career as a media worker and legal activist. We're going to be discussing Chris's new book, Crashing the Party, Legacies and Lessons from the RNC 2000. Chris, are you there?
I'm here. Hi,
oh,
Emma.
Great. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you doing?
Oh, great. Thank you. Welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So, Chris, let's jump right into it, and let's start first by talking about your book. Can you tell me a little bit about this book that you've just written?
Sure. It's a labor of love that just got published recently, this past August. which happened to mark the 15th anniversary of the Republican convention in Philadelphia in 2000. And that's really what the book centers around, is not the Republican convention per se, but the political protests that surrounded it and the police response to those protests and what activists did to fight back against an oppressive legal system. And I think because there are many stories associated with the events that happened back 15 years ago, it's an important part of our political history, I believe, and I think it holds many lessons for activists today in terms of what to expect from the law enforcement community, but also how to resist and confront the legal system effectively and collectively. That is one of the main themes of the book, is how to engage in collective resistance and really overcome or gain power in a situation that it tries to make us powerless, namely the jail system and the prison system.
Okay, so let's talk about this from the perspective of the book and from the particular period that the book is centered on, and then let's expand outward. So let's go into the Wayback Machine to the year 2000, and it was the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Were you there, Chris?
I was there. I had co-founded this legal collective, R2K Legal, and we were prepared for this political summit, and it was in the midst of the global justice movement, and it was preceded by the WTO protest in Seattle about 8 or 9 months previously, and the IMF World Bank protests in Washington, D.C. only 3 months earlier. Mm-hmm. And we were planning to support activists in the streets if they did get arrested. What we weren't really prepared for is the years-long legal support effort that was necessary to really challenge the state in a meaningful way.
So going back to the RNC protests of the year 2000, that was the year that George Bush was running for president, and Al Gore and Ralph Nader and some other people too. And the Republican National Convention was meeting in Philadelphia. And what were some of the issues that the activists who were there, what was their message, and how did they try to express that message?
Well, there was a whole range of issues that people were addressing, from access to health care to poor people's economic rights to black bloc anarchist roaming the streets to... on August 1st, which was the day of mass arrests, there was a coordinated demonstration against the prison industrial complex, which included police violence, the death penalty, specifically the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was on death row at the time, and other aspects of the prison industrial complex. And so that brought thousands of people to the streets to blockade the downtown area and make it difficult for Republican delegates to get to the convention, which was a few miles away to the south.
So just, you know, for full disclosure, I was there too, and I was one of those people. And I remember the RNC so well. So, how did the activists choose to express their resistance, and what did the police do in response to that?
Well, I think to start with, it was the plan was to do traditional blockade actions using the affinity group model. so maybe 5 to 20 people would get together in a group and collectively decide where in the city they were going to try to cause a disruption and engage in civil disobedience by blocking traffic. And so what resulted was a congestion all across the downtown area, very similar to what happened in Seattle months previously. And very effectively, activists shut down the WPO meetings. There wasn't necessarily an expectation that activists would shut down the Republican convention, but certainly they wanted to let it be known that they weren't willing to accept business as usual.
Mm-hmm. And how did the police respond?
Well, the police responded quite violently. There were numerous cases of activists being assaulted. There was less in the way of chemical weapons, although a significant brute force, billy clubs and fists, bicycles were used against activists, horses, and there was some pepper spray, but the chemical weapons were not used as much by the police commissioner at that time, but very violent, and there were mass arrests. More than 400 people were arrested and sent to jail. And that's essentially, on the way to jail is when people embarked on a form of solidarity called jail solidarity, which is a time-honored tactic in the United States to try and clog up the jails.
So let's talk about that. What is involved in jail solidarity? What did the activists do that maybe people wouldn't know or expect?
Well, over time, people have used these tactics differently, but in the contemporary era around 1999-2000, when the global justice movement was at its apex, people were primarily withholding their identity. So they would not carry a driver's license or any other identification on them. In the event that they got arrested, they would choose an action name or an alias, and people would really unify under the anonymous identity of Jane and John Doe. And in this way, with hundreds of people refusing to cooperate in the jail system, essentially refusing to be identified, to be processed. In some cases, people refused to be fingerprinted. There were other non-cooperation tactics used in jail that made the lives of the jail authorities very difficult. In that way, activists hoped to clog up the jail system, and in so doing, used their collective strength to negotiate early release, basically negotiate low-level charges or no charges at all. And this happened just a couple of months previously in Washington, D.C. There was a very effective use of jail solidarity, and everybody, most people, almost everyone, got out on a traffic violation, essentially an infraction, and a very minimal fine, and everybody walked away. But unfortunately, in Philadelphia, the mayor, the police commissioner, and the district attorney all dug their heels in and refused to negotiate with the activists, and hundreds of people were forced to stay in jail for as long as 2 weeks. So the effort to get out quickly on low-level charges was unsuccessful. However, while people were in jail, there were tactics used that were aimed at protecting people who were being targeted or marginalized, and that included people of color, queer folk, immigrants, and others who, for whatever reason, maybe they were known organizers, targeted for harsher treatment. And there were certain tactics that activists engaged in, whether it was banging for hours incessantly on the walls and the bars of the jail cell, or singing, chanting, or sometimes refusing to let someone be taken away, often into solitary confinement. There were an array of tactics used to help protect people. That part was more successful than the overall effort to get out of jail quickly.
So what was different about the RNC, and not just the aspect of the response of the city and the response of the mayor, but also in the streets, what was different about the use of force by the police at the RNC?
Well, I think what really happened is police studied what happened in Seattle, what happened in Washington, D.C. Previously in the months prior to the Republican convention. And this was well documented. The police commissioner at the time, John Timoney, and other law enforcement officials traveled to these cities to study what the police reaction was, what protesters were doing, what their tactics and strategies were. And they took that knowledge and started to develop what I argue was a new policing model for the country. And keep in mind, this was prior to 9/11, so there wasn't this fervor to address the so-called issue of terrorism. But there was a development of a policing model. Really, Philadelphia acted as a laboratory for John Timoney to develop a fairly repressive policing model that included an array of tactics that are still used to this day. So even though it was middle class, mostly middle class, white global justice activists in 2000 who were mistreated and used as pawns in the development of this policing model, the activists of today can still gain insight from understanding this model and countering it with their own tactics and strategies. But some examples of the tactics that were developed in that day that are still used today include generally denying people protest permits, so preventing people from lawfully demonstrating in the streets. A lot of people today refuse to even apply for permits, but for those who want to, you know, comport to the state's procedures of protesting in the streets, there are permit schemes that exist, but cities have to be willing to grant permits, and Philadelphia had refused and was taken to court over that. In addition, you had heavy surveillance and infiltration, spying on political groups without probable cause. You had interrogations by all levels of law enforcement, local, state, and federal. You had unlawful stops and searches. If you looked like an activist, you might be stopped and your bag searched, again, without cause, just by your presentation.
Was this the origin of stop and frisk?
Yeah, very much like stop and frisk. I can't say that the official stop and frisk policies that you might see in New York or Chicago reflect exactly what was learned from these summit protests, but certainly the tactics are similar. And they're going around using the pretext that people could be carrying weapons or, planning illegal or violent acts to search everybody's possessions. And that's an unlawful pretext. And has been challenged.
It sounds like part of what you're describing, Chris, is that a whole set of repressive tactics was first tried out on mostly middle-class white protesters of privilege, but then those tactics became, de rigueur, instrumental in the policing of people of color.
It's true. Today there's a very vital movement for Black Lives that is being repressed by the same tactics, for sure. But we saw the development of what I've already explained and more. There's preemptive raids, mass arrests, police violence. All of this is included in the police playbook, if you will. And a lot of this was used against Occupy activists, and a movement was effectively suppressed in 2011 using these same tactics.
Yeah.
But yes, today, these are the tactics that are being used against Black youth who are fighting for their lives, really, in the streets today.
Yeah. What about the use of weaponry, technology, and materials? How has that changed? How did Philadelphia create a change in the use of materials for surveillance, for incarceration, and for oppression of civil liberties?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and there are layers to it. For example, surveillance and infiltration is something that police have been doing for decades, and it's not new. Wasn't new when it happened in Philadelphia, and it's not new today. The technology that they use to surveil on us, though, has become more known, at least in some circles, and certainly being able to monitor telephone conversations and access to internet and social media accounts and so forth is much more ubiquitous today. Well, in fact, there wasn't social media back in 2000, and cell phones were much less frequently used. By one standard, you could say that social media has advanced our capability in political organizing, and cell phones with cameras have revolutionized the way that we might be able to keep police accountable. At the same time, these technologies are very porous and they can be used against us as well. So we have to be aware of that. But the weaponry that is used today is very much advanced from what we saw in 2000. It's interesting, though, Police Commissioner John Timoney went on to become the police chief in Miami and took what he learned in Philadelphia and applied it in spades in Miami, whereas in Philadelphia, more brute force was used. In Miami, a whole panoply of weaponry, much of it militaristic, was used against protesters in what was probably one of the most violent episodes of modern political history.
Chris, just to let people know, you're talking about the Free Trade Area of the Americas protests, which happened in Miami.
Yes, in November of 2003, people came to Miami and residents of Miami to protest what was then a significant trade agreement on the table that was ultimately overcome politically, and it was not ratified. But the state felt threatened and came out very violently against demonstrators and used chemical weapons, including tear gas and pepper spray.
And rubber bullets.
I'm sorry?
Rubber bullets, beanbag bullets.
Rubber bullets, yeah, a whole array of projectile weapons, rubber, wooden bullets, beanbag rounds, electrical weapons, including tasers and electric shields. The LRAD was used, which is a long-range
device. Mm-hmm. That weird black thing. Yeah.
Yeah, this represented the beginning of the sort of what we might call the militarization of the police force that we see today, and of course that has extended even more towards the repressive nature today.
Yeah. So let's wrap it up just by, we've got about 5 minutes left, so I just want to move toward conclusion. Let's talk a little bit more about your book, Chris. Where can people, I can't do any kind of selling here or advertising. So tell me just a little bit more about your book, what inspired write it, and, you know, maybe where people can go to look for more information about it.
Well, again, I thought it was important to document these stories as a part of our legal and political history, and not a lot has been written about these issues, especially from a legal or legal worker lens as I'm conveying them. Specifically, I want to talk about the success of court solidarity, which is a very big part of the book. People took the solidarity tactics that they used in jail and translated them into the courtroom. And activists, being facilitated by R2K Legal, the collective that I was part of, to establish confrontational tactics and resistance in the courtroom. And ultimately, they succeeded in dismissing or acquitting almost all of the cases. And we had a very effective media strategy that went along with that to make sure the public was aware of what really happened and that the plight of the activists was really vindicated. And so in that way, we turned the tables and made this a huge success story. And that's conveyed in the book in a very deep way.
Well, thank you so much for doing that work with R2K Legal. I remember at the time I was doing indie media and I was part of the IMC collective. And I just remember all the collectives that just came together. People just came to do, you know, share their skills and really do what they knew that they could do well. And it created a community, you know, a really solid community of resistance that I think was a really beautiful thing. And, you know, I think that we kind of did that again for a while during Occupy 4 years ago.
Yes, it was beautiful, and it's inspiring to see the unrest happening in the streets today, and what we can do inside the courtroom. You know, anything's possible. So I hope people take this information to heart.
Yeah. So, Chris, if people want to find out more information about your book, again, this is a nonprofit, so we can't do any kind of selling here, but if people want to find out more about your book, do you have a website or a page?
We're on Facebook under Crashing the Party, and we have a website which is crashingthepartythebook.com, and I invite everyone to check it out.
Great. And just to wrap it up, Chris, can you tell us a little bit about what are you doing now?
Well, right now I am working with the National Lawyers Guild as its mass defense coordinator, which means that I'm coordinating support for mass demonstrations going on around the country. And so we're in very exciting times with the Movement for Black Lives, which we're supporting with great strength and inspiration.
Great. All right. Well, Chris, thank you so much for being on Prison Pipeline. It's really been a pleasure to connect with you after 15 years. And keep up the positive work. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Will do. Take care.
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Community Radio. Prison Pipeline is a weekly show that addresses all aspects of the prison industrial complex, especially how to abolish it. We are a collective, which means that we have different hosts every week, and we strive for trying to educate and make people aware of the fundamental injustices of the prison system and how we can take steps to address those. So thank you very much, and we'll see you next week on Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
This Tuesday, Katrina Vandenhoebel, editor, publisher, and part owner of The Nation magazine, will be live on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's this Tuesday, live on KBOO 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hemp Stock Harvest Festival, October 17th and 18th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. Portland's annual Hemp Stock Harvest Festival in Portland, Oregon, advocates decriminalization of cannabis for medicinal, industrial, and recreational use. It will feature food vendors, guest speakers, and live music, including a performance by John Trudell and Bad Dog. Again, that's the Hemp Stock Harvest Festival, October 17th and 18th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies, the Portland Women's Crisis Line and West Women and Children's Shelter. Again, that's Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants